Investors Chronicle.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter from the Investors Chronicle, and today I'm very pleased to welcome a guest you may be familiar with, either from your own portfolios or simply from what you hear about what's going on in markets and some of the kind of more prominent stocks of recent years. That's Stephen Yu. Stephen is the lead fund manager on the Blue Whale Growth Fund. Blue Whale Growth launched in late 2017, and it became a bit of perhaps an upstart among the global equity funds. It made some very good returns from a high conviction portfolio with around between 25 to 35 stocks often, and with a focus on the likes of the FANG companies, among others. That focus, of course, did leave the fund in the eye of the storm when markets turned last year. And having made some really, really strong returns in previous years, it was down by just shy of 28% for 2022, which is a common story for many of the kind of popular funds you might hold. So, Stephen, thank you for joining us today. As we speak, so worth noting, due to the sort of logistics of scheduling, we are speaking in mid-February. Things could always turn. But without jinxing it, as we speak, markets have been a little bit healthier so far, rallied quite strongly. But there are concerns that this is simply a bear rally, and you know, it's all kind of hot air, and things could quickly turn quite negative again. I know that you're not a macro investor. You do have more of a bottom-up approach, but it's interesting how kind of macro-focused everything's been in the last year or so. We've been obsessed with inflation. We've been obsessed with recession concerns for very good reason. But in terms of how that is affecting what you're doing in the portfolio, what are your main concerns? What are you trying to kind of get the fund ready for at this point?
Thank you, David. So if we look back to 2022 performance, which is a very important year for us in terms of that since inception, that we didn't do very well in 2022. And if I try to break down the performance into the first half of last year and the second half of last year until to date, that you can see that all the underperformance or the losses happened in the first 6 months of last year. And that obviously would be attributed to the interest rate risk in terms of valuation resets on some of our company, which we deem as very high quality. At the same time, they have structural growth drivers for the many years to come. If we just refer to how the market have done since July last year until to date, we can probably say the interest rate risk has come down dramatically, or we are approaching the end of the interest rate rise cycle. So I think that is quite clear that if you believe that's the case, then it means that in terms of further valuation resets for some of our company to become become cheaper from here is going to be more difficult. So the biggest risk in the market going forward from here would be the risk of a recession, which is something that we have been talking about since sometime last year. It still have not happened yet. And you might have seen the UK data that the UK, even for the UK economy, we have basically escaped the recession in the last quarter. And so, but of course, I mean, this is not just a quarterly thing. The economy is slowing down on the back of higher interest rate, mortgage rate, squeeze on consumer spending, higher energy bills, et cetera, et cetera. So a recession is inevitable. Okay, we can debate on whether the recession is going to be a prolonged recession, is going to be a severe recession, or is going to be a shallow recession. We don't know that yet, but it's going to be a bit more clearer later this year. So the important thing from our perspective is to invest into high quality businesses that could survive and if not benefit or become stronger on the back of recession. So the recession risk is now a lot higher than interest rate risk. And of course, if we do go into a recession, you can expect that interest rate could be lower, that central bankers might reduce the interest rate just to smooth out the recovery in the economy.
And how does that affect kind of what you do and don't like in the fund? I mean, the fund has often been associated, as I mentioned, with quite a preference for tech and US tech, although that's not everything you invest in. Yeah, how does that affect which names you like there? Because of course, last year you sort of bailed out of many of the so-called FANG stocks, and you do still retain some exposures elsewhere.
Correct. So we are very cautious about anything that's consumer facing. So whether they are tech companies or not tech companies. And this is because that it's not just about a recession that we're talking about. We are talking about continuous squeeze on consumer spending in terms of higher energy bills, mortgage rates, and inflation, obviously, and food prices and all that stuff. So in terms of our day-to-day disposable income into the next, let's say, 2 to 3 years, I think it's fair to assume that we will have less money to spend, or selectively that we need to spend on certain things that are necessities rather than discretionary. So anything that's related to discretionary spending or consumer facing, we are very cautious of. Then within the tech space, if you look at the likes of Amazon, Alphabet, Google, or Facebook, they are all consumer facing. So of course, Amazon would be through e-commerce that we could be shopping less online because we have less money to spare. And then as far as Google, Alphabet is concerned, from an advertiser's perspective, that if people are not buying the goods, or if people are not being converted to make the transactions while they are clicking on the advert, then advertisers would be spending less money on Google, for example. So anything that we think could be impacted on the back of a squeeze on consumer spending, we have exited since late 2021 and then throughout 2022 as well. But of course, that would be names that we are still backing that we think they could benefit. And I'm sure we will touch on some of this further in the podcast.
Just staying with that kind of idea, one name I was interested to see on your fact sheets is Charles Schwab. I mean, is that not, I suppose it isn't necessarily consumer spending per se, but isn't that quite vulnerable to recession, to people getting worried about markets falling, and just to that kind of sentiment dropping off?
So we started our investment in Charles Schwab during the summer of 2021. And that was on the back of our recognition that interest rate is going to be higher from where we were in 2021. Of course, one thing that we didn't expect was the level of interest rate is going to go to such a high level. So in the US now, it's going to be about 5%. We thought maybe it would have stopped at about 3-4%. The reason that Charles Schwab is going to do quite well is similar to a bank, that they make money through the net interest margin, which means that they don't, if for customers on the Charles Schwab platform, which is the largest investment platform in the US, you don't get paid a lot of interest on your cash balance, which is typically about 10% of your portfolio will be sitting in cash. At the same time, Charles Schwab would be able to invest those cash into high yielding products. So they basically get the net interest margin. And if you believe, which is our base case scenario, that interest rate is going to stay higher for longer, doesn't mean like it would need to stay at 5% for the next 3 years. It could be 4%, but we're not going back to the 2% regime in the next couple of years. So if interest rate is going to stay higher for longer, then Charles Schwab would be able to make a lot more money in the next 3 years compared to the last 3 years. And of course, if you're looking at the recession risk about maybe the jittery in the equity market, of course, Charles Schwab would be part of that. Looking at the inflows into in terms of new customers addition, it shows that Charles Schwab is still in a very strong position to capitalize on that. So balancing out the pros and cons in terms of a recession risk, at the same time, the interest rate staying higher for longer, that we believe that the valuation of Charles Schwab is very attractive and they would be able to make more money in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's interesting. You're perhaps seeing similar things with some of the very well-known brokers in the UK benefiting from their cash exposure. Turning to, I suppose, a different development in the fund, which you addressed in your own literature, people might have been surprised to see a kind of energy exposure popping up in the fund. And as mentioned, you've kind of made some, I suppose, dramatic moves away from some of the kind of FANG stocks in the around the middle points of last year. That did strike me as, I suppose, quite a contrast with your stated focus on kind of high quality companies, attractive valuations. When you actually came on this podcast in mid-2021, you were talking about kind of you wouldn't want cyclical exposures like banks, but also like energy companies. I mean, does this not open you up to accusations of kind of style drift? You know, how would you counter any concerns about that?
Yeah, so I would first have to say the short answer that this is not style drift. We are still only want to buy companies that are of very high quality at the same time at attractive valuation. How we define that is we prefer that the free cash flow delivery trajectory from a company is going to be very high, or likelihood of the company achieving their targets very high rather than a bit uncertain. So what it means is if I put alongside Google, alongside, let's say, Canadian Natural Resources, which is the new energy company that we invested into, is in the next 3 to 5 years, or let's say next 3 years, we would believe that the free cash flow delivery from Canadian Natural Resources would be significantly higher compared to Google, just because that for Google, we already talk about the uncertainty in consumer spending, which could drag on for some time. On the other hand, that on the back of the Ukraine crisis, at the same time, the geopolitics uncertainties in Asia between China and Taiwan, also the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the US, we recognize that the oil price could be well supported at a higher level versus the previous cycle, despite a recession is yet to come. So what does that actually mean? It means that historically, oil price is very much driven by supply and demand. So if the economy is booming, the oil price can go up to about $100. If the global economy is in a recession, the oil price can go back down to $40 to $50. So it makes the oil price very cyclical. If you're a company operating within that regime, then it makes you quite cyclical or low quality businesses. But given all the uncertainty that we talk about in terms of geopolitics, that we would suggest that the oil price could be well supported at the current level, let's say $70 to $80 for the next couple of years. So we are not forecasting that oil price need to go up to $100 or more, but we are suggesting that based on our research that the oil price could be supported at the current level for longer. So what it means is, if we can find an oil producer, which is the one that we have got, that the cost of production per barrel of oil is sub $30 and $40, it means that it's a bit similar to your Charles Schwab scenario. They are able to make the free cash flow delivery in terms of the probability of them meeting that target is very high in the next few years. So let's assume that oil price remain at $70 to $80 for the next 3 years. So there's no inflation because the oil prices remain constant. Then if you're producing oil at $30 and $40 per barrel, it means that you're going to make quite a lot of money in the next couple of years. And the one thing, going back to your questions at the beginning about the macro uncertainties, is the macro environment is very challenging at the moment. Despite the fact that we are not in a recession on a technical basis, there's a lot of worries in the market in terms of about consumers, about the post-pandemic implications, in terms of the staff shortages. It's very difficult to find a single, find a company in the industry that would basically have no issues whatsoever in the next couple of years. Of course, I mean, you marry the pros and cons and try to marry that with valuation of the company to make sure that you're buying something that already have priced in the uncertainties. But that's not like a single thing that you can say from our research that this company would just able to do whatever in the next few years, despite what's going on in the world. Like even in the context of Microsoft, is our top 10 holdings, we're still backing it, and you would have seen the shares has recovered quite nicely in the last couple of weeks on the back of the AI or ChatGPT. But if we do go into a recession globally, then Microsoft would be exposed to that. So let's say if European companies are cutting down or shutting down their factories or offices, then we would have less Office 365 workers, which means Microsoft would be making less money. So it's not like foolproof that they are not going to go make less money in the context of recession. However, in the context of the Canadian natural resources, the energy company we have got, which we only have one at the moment, is they could still continue to deliver the free cash flow that we expect them to do, assuming the oil price stay at the current level. So that makes this company very high quality. And of course, one thing that we have always done is we are highly selective in terms of how we define a high quality company, such as the management team, return on invested capital profile, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, a lot of people or maybe value managers or managers that doesn't have the quality focus could be buying into BP or Shell or some other names. I'm sure you would equally make a lot of money on the back of that thesis. It's just from our perspective that we are highly selective. So if we couldn't have found this company, we wouldn't have invested into the energy sector, if that makes sense.
So you don't would you see yourself sort of picking up more names in the sector? Is there anything else that's been, although you may not be able to name it, is there anything else that's been kind of, you know, ticking those boxes?
I think this goes back to our investment philosophy that we are bottom up, we are highly selective, and then we focus on the quality of the business to start with. So to you, use another example, which is linking back to Charles Schwab, is we talk about that we don't invest into banks because we just cannot get comfortable about the complexity behind the balance sheet in a bank. Like, you never get to the bottom of how the asset is being risk adjusted, the weighting, the liabilities, and all that. Of course, now, like, you will keep reading on the headlines continuously about the different scandals that's happening within the banking sector. It's just from an external investor perspective, you just never get a clear idea of what goes on behind the business model. But obviously, if you believe that interest rates are going to go up, I mean, banks is going to make a lot more money. But from our perspective, we are not going to invest into banks. So if we couldn't have managed to found a company called Charles Schwab, which is exposed to a similar dynamic without the complexity on the balance sheet that we are very comfortable with in terms of the quality of the business, then we wouldn't have invested in this company, or we wouldn't have invested into a company that would benefit from a rising interest rate environment. So that is exactly the same as what we do in the energy space, that we're highly selective. We start the process from a bottom-up perspective. We can find something, then we would be interested. If we couldn't, then we would just go somewhere else to look for other ideas.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mention that, you know, I suppose no company is without its risks at the minute. And there are so many immense macro uncertainties. You know, I was looking earlier that you do have names like ASML and NVIDIA in the portfolio. And, you know, semiconductor players have been very popular for good reason, but also they can become a bit of a political football with China and the US, for example. Bearing in mind those uncertainties, do you therefore, you know, your fund literature states that, you know, the buy and hold mantra and the idea of kind of making capital returns over a 5-year period, does that change given those uncertainties? Does it become more of a sort of ducking and diving? Do you have to kind of turn over the portfolio more as you try and deal with these unknowns?
So not so much. It all depends on the companies in itself. So for the companies that we have less conviction or we are less clear about the growth trajectory in the next few years, we would have already exited those names as we talk about the FANGs. In the context of the semiconductors, is a very interesting sector in a way that we, on our top 10, we have both ASML and Lam Research. If you follow what is going on in the industry itself, it's all about reshoring opportunities. People talk about reshoring opportunities as like a fancy theme. If you really want to zero in, like which industry is going to benefit the most, is semiconductors equipment companies. if you follow what's going on in the industry, there's a slide produced by ASML that shows about over $300 billion has been committed to build new semiconductor foundry across the world, in the US, in Europe, in Japan, and in South Korea. So about $300 billion worth. Why is so much money being spent to build new foundry? It's because of the reshoring opportunities going on the back of the geopolitics in Asia Pacific, especially in Taiwan, what China might do to the TSMC assets in Taiwan. So the world is quite concerned that So hence the government, both in the US and the EU, have come up with tax subsidies to incentivize semiconductor company to build new foundry in their own territory. So which means that if you're the company that's selling the mission critical equipments like ASML and Lam Research, then you're going to sell many more of your equipment in the next many years. So what has happened in 2022? Obviously, there's a few things that why ASML and Lam Research have not done well in terms of the share price performance was on the back of a reduction in consumer demand for some of the consumer-facing gadgets like PCs, smartphones, memory, and all the stuff. So that is cyclical. That is not the place to be. And at the same time, we will be reading all the headlines about, US is going to impose restriction in terms of some of these companies selling their technology or equipment to the Chinese players and all that stuff. And of course, that caused a bit of jittery in the share price. The way that we assess the thesis is over the medium term, 3 to 5 years, these two companies or this sector is going to make a lot more money compared to the last 3 years. The shorter term, headwinds is not helpful, hence the shares has not done well. But if you can look through the shorter term, like you can actually see where they're heading. So in contrast to the FANGs, the shorter term is uncertain, but then the longer term is equally uncertain as well. So hence, that is why we are still backing the likes of ASML and Lam Research. And of course, I mean, I'm very happy to talk about NVIDIA, that on the back of the kind of the introduction of ChatGPT, you can see that AI is now more of a real thing to most people than compared to before. It's only available to the scientists or to the PhDs.
How do you, when it comes to, I suppose, the and using this term very broadly, but the tech names, how do you kind of assess those trends by what looks genuinely promising and what looks perhaps like, guff, to use a weird word. For example, you know, the metaverse has been a very divisive kind of subject. And I suppose NVIDIA has had quite an interest in that, but some managers would be quite skeptical. But you mentioned ChatGPT, which is very interesting.
Yes, I think in contrast to, so we like NVIDIA a lot. It's one of our favorite companies. Mm. I think using maybe metaverse, which is something I'm slightly skeptical about. I'm a believer in the metaverse, but I'm just slightly skeptical on the timing of the metaverse in our day to day, like for most people. So hence we are not a fan of Facebook or Meta that we exited quite early on this time last year. The reason for my skepticism on metaverse is all about the timing. Right, it could be a 5-year thing, which might be unlikely. It could be a 20-year thing. It could be a 50-year thing. It could be the next generation. It might not even be my generation, people who actually want to spend a lot of their time at home with the goggle, like in terms of living in the metaverse. And one thing that I actually could come up with a scenario that when that might happen is when global warming become quite a severe kind of phenomenon in the world, that we can no longer go outside of our home because it's just unlivable, the world. Then maybe we would end up living in the metaverse, right? Okay, is that going to come soon? It's probably unlikely. Is it going to come at some point? It could be. And this is a bit similar to your pandemic, the pandemic period, that at the time is most people wouldn't have dreamt about shopping online. Most people wouldn't have dreamt about doing meetings in like the face-to-face meetings, in contrast to that, doing that at home. And suddenly they realize actually there's quite a lot of benefit with hybrid working, working from home, shopping online, doing a lot of things at home rather than you have to physically go outside to do it. But the pandemic was the proven point that it forced a lot of people to revisit kind of the habits in terms of, oh, maybe I could change this. So Metaverse is going to face a similar hurdle. And unless we have something very dramatic in the next many years, hopefully not, then the adoption rate could be quite slow. So what I'm saying is, like, if you want to invest in the Metaverse, I probably want to maybe wait until I can see some clear signs of Metaverse being adopted. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, I don't want to be too early. I don't want to be like 10 years early. I want to be maybe 5 years early or 3 years early before it become important. And this is similar thing when you look at the internet or the online world ecosystem. It's, of course, internet has been around since the 1990s. Amazon has been around since the 1990s. So is many more companies. But because we didn't have the infrastructure in terms of the fiber connection, the 5G, and even the smartphone that could allow us to do many things anytime that we want, that the adoption of many of these online services have not been able to capture the bigger audience. It was only until when Apple decided to launch an iPhone in 2008, and at the same time that by the time you get to 2014, then most people would be using a smartphone rather than your Nokia or BlackBerry and all that. Then it allows many apps or services to capture the biggest audience. That's how you make the most money. I mean, Facebook wasn't even around during the 1990s. I mean, it was a company that started in the late 2000s. So that's what I'm saying about the Metaverse is at some point we will get there, but we're not there yet. I mean, that's a similar thing as blockchain, isn't it? Or maybe crypto. I'm sure at some point we would have a digital currency, and you would have seen Bank of England is already considering that they might want to do something in the next 5 to 10 years. So, but it could take some time.
So in terms of those kind of tech trends, it's mainly you've mentioned AI. Is there anything else that's kind of standing out you think as kind of already having established itself and looking like a interesting driver of returns in the coming years?
I think AI is actually quite big space in itself, because you're not only talking about the likes of the ChatGPT, which is a bit more kind of services oriented, about more intellectual kind of the services sector. You're talking about automation in factories. You're talking about autonomous driving in terms of when you look at some of the high-end cars that's being produced now, you would have all the sensors that could allow the cars to sense all the different objects around where you are going. And then at some point, the autonomous driving is going to take shape as well. And then you do need to have the likes of the NVIDIA GPU to power that. So the AI in itself is a bit like your like a generic terms, but the implication of that is enormous in terms of recommendation. And also at the same time, one thing that we talk about, like before the ChatGPT comes in, how you understand about the maybe AI or analytics is when you go onto YouTube or go to Amazon to buy something. Once you have, let's say, go onto YouTube and watch a video for like 30 seconds or a minute, you would have seen some recommendation quite quickly to suggest to you, oh, maybe you're interested in this video too, maybe whatever that is. Or once you bought a product, Amazon would recommend you to say, oh, maybe you're interested to have a look at this. Historically, how this has been done is done by sampling. So Amazon or Google would have some of your data, let's say your age group, your demographics, where you are based, what you have done before, looking at your history, looking at your 3 years history, your browsing data, or maybe your transaction data on Amazon. But nowadays, you no longer need to do any of this. A lot of this computing and analytics is done on a real-time basis. So what it means is Google or Amazon doesn't need to know as much about you compared to before. And now a lot of this is done through real-time analytics and a bit of like artificial intelligence behind the scene as well, as learning about you real time. What do you like to see after this video? What has been your actions telling them that what you would like. So basically, there's many applications on the back of this that could be quite powerful, which is yet to come.
And sticking with the, I suppose, the tech allocation, that's, as I've mentioned a couple of times, that's something the fund has been very strongly linked with. Although you do protest you're not a tech fund, you have greater scope than that. How would you see that kind of mix shifting? I mean, I think end of January you had what, around, I know the definitions are very subjective perhaps, but around 45% in tech. How does that compare with sort of early years of the fund? And would you see that kind of increasing, or how do you see it shaping up?
Yeah, so the definition on the fact sheet is slightly misleading because it's done by some standard industry categorization. And as some people might know, that MasterCard and Visa has always been considered as a technology company. So that include in that 45%, which MasterCard and Visa account for about 10% of the fund in total. So so once we categorize some of these names, that our technology exposure is a bit lower. So if I look at the way that we categorize whether a company is a technology or not, so let's say Microsoft, Nvidia, ASML would be considered as technology, then at the moment we have about a quarter of the fund in technology, about 25 to 30%. Historically, I think especially during the pandemic period, when we would have the likes of Amazon, PayPal, Google, Facebook on our top 10, which you don't see that anymore. I mean, they're not even in the fund. Then at the time, I think we would probably have peaked at about maybe 40%, I'm guessing, at the time, two years ago now. So we are now being very selective. Of course, I mean, we still like companies that can grow over the medium term and take a bigger share of the world GDP. We think that those companies or sectors could be coming from a different place outside of tech. So historically, it was really about tech. And going back to some of the stocks that we talked about earlier, about Charles Schwab or Canadian Natural Resources, we also invested into the US railroads. Is 5 years ago, we would not be interested in those companies, because we couldn't see why this company would end up taking a bigger share of the world GDP in 2022. But now, based on our research on the back of the geopolitics uncertainty in terms of the reshoring opportunities, that in the next 5 years, we can see that these company or sectors could take a bigger share of the world GDP, and some of our money is going to be spent with this company rather than just the tech companies. So the interesting thing about in terms of our investable universe is, in contrast to what some commentators might suggest, that a lot of shares has become cheaper now, surely there's more hunting ground to look for tech investment. To us, our investable universe within the technology space or digital transformation space have actually shrunk. So we have actually seen our investable universe become smaller in terms of what we would like to invest into as far as technology is concerned. So hence, when you look at our top 10 holdings now, like we have some medical equipment companies like Sartorius and Dexcom. They are healthcare equipment companies, but then in terms of the growth opportunity they have is very attractive. It's very structural. And we would rather to have the likes of Dexcom or Sartorius than, let's say, Google or Facebook. Which wasn't the case, let's say, 5 years ago.
Yeah. I was going to ask kind of where, you know, if tech is kind of less of a sweet spot now, where is looking more interesting? I mean, you mentioned healthcare. Is there anywhere else where you think, take an optimistic note, there is kind of a greater opportunity set than there was?
It's a difficult one. Obviously, we, from our perspective, we would have tried our best to pick the best 25 stocks within our investable universe, and hence the names that you see in our top 10 and names that we have talked about before. The one thing that I would say is the world is very challenging in terms of outlook. It's just impossible to find a clear winner. But if you can take a medium-term view, which is about 3 to 5 years from our perspective in terms of how we model a company, how much money they're going to make, the investment thesis, the outlook for this company, then yeah, we are backing the companies that we we have got in the fund. And of course, we continue to look for better opportunities, but there's many names that we used to like before that we no longer like them as much. So I give you one example is Adobe. So Adobe has been featured as our top 10 companies, top 10 holdings in the fund since inception until Q2 2022. And then you no longer see Adobe in our top 10. And now we still have a very small position in the fund. We're revising our investment thesis in Adobe. The thing with Adobe is it's a very good company, right? Adobe is not going to disappear. If people have used that product, you know that product, Photoshop and video editing app, is very good. Their business model is very robust in terms of subscription and all that stuff. But the problem with Adobe is like, what are they going to do in the next 5 years? How are they going to take more market share from here in terms of digital transformation, in terms of creative campaigns? And if you're worried about the world might be going backwards in terms of discretionary spending, then maybe it's going to be a lot more difficult for Adobe to grow. So hence, it's all comes back to where the world is heading in the next couple of years. And what we're saying is the world is very uncertain. There's many things that you could expect to happen. It might or might not happen, but then you need to be prepared for that. So we are highly selective in terms of what we're looking at. The last thing I would say is, like, surely if you look at the kind of the ChatGPT space or the AI space, there are probably quite a few small companies that are listed in the market that would have done very well. I think I've seen a few names that have gone up like a few 100% in the last couple of weeks. Very small company. They're probably not, I mean, they're definitely not making money or anything like that. However, it wouldn't have fit our criteria because the competitive positioning has not yet been established. So you know that, yeah, AI is a good theme to be in, but then how do you actually pick the company? The conclusion that we ended up always is NVIDIA would be the names to pick as far as the AI space is concerned. You don't actually need to know who is going to win. Is that going to be Bing.com with ChatGPT or Google/Bart? Like, you don't need that. You still need to have the NVIDIA GPU to power those queries. So hence, I think when you go down into the kind of the bottom of research, then the opportunity set is even smaller than the high level thematic or the themes, because ultimately you want to do much better than the market, not just buying some themes but in some bad companies.
Do you find yourself then, I mean, you've mentioned, for example, equipment providers in certain spaces, do you find yourself tempted more to the what people like to call sort of picks and shovels plays than the like direct plays on a theme?
Yes, I think we have a bit of both. I think we definitely have a bit of both. So in terms of the semiconductors, equipment companies like ASM and Lam Research, I think that fits the bill. In terms of the Sartorius equipment in the healthcare space, in biologics, they produce the equipment for the COVID vaccine drugs makers to deliver the drugs. So that is something that we like. But at the same time, does depends on the sectors or the underlying growth driver in itself. So let's say NVIDIA is the pioneer in terms of what they do. You can't really invest into the picture shuffle. Like, that is the company that is going to be the face of the product in terms of, I mean, that's the product they're making. At the same time, I think for Canadian Natural Resources, some people would have asked, oh, why don't you invest into the equivalent of the semiconductors or healthcare space and go into some old services company, or maybe even like maybe some other things that works within the oil industry. That doesn't actually work at all, because the thesis from our perspective about the oil price going to stay at a high level for longer is because of the level of underinvestment for the last many years. And of course, because of the geopolitics, because of, let's say, the sanction on Russia, there's going to be even less investment into the energy sector. So which means that the oil price could be well supported because the supply is heavily constrained, not only for the last many years, but in the next many years at the same time. So let's say if you were to invest into the oil services sector, you are hoping that those energy company is going to spend a lot more money to expand the the level investment or to build new old fields. Like, that's not the case. I mean, you would have seen some of the old majors, they are making a lot of money, but they're not spending the money. They're returning the money to shareholders.
And in terms of, I suppose, turning to another element of many global funds, you do have a sizable exposure to North America. As I've said, it's quite a common sight in that sector. Does that still remain the kind of unbeatable market when it comes to things like earnings strength? Or would you see yourself kind of moving more into, upping your still relatively sizable Europe allocation? Or would you, you don't have much in Asia, for example, would you go more directly into that market?
Yeah, so the one thing that is all equally slightly misleading on a fact sheet is it shows that we have about 66-67% invested in US equities, and that number have not really changed in the last 5 years. So we have always got about 2/3 of the fund invested into US listed companies. But what have changed though is when you look at the underlying revenue of where these companies are generating from, that composition have evolved. So historically, when we were invested into the FANGs, let's say Amazon, Google, and Facebook, they are all global companies. So about 50% of the revenue would be coming outside North America. So let's say in Europe or Asia. And we liked those companies at the time because of the digital transformation opportunities. But since then, while you would have seen that we are still heavily exposed to US equities, but the composition of those revenue streams have changed dramatically, that we're now investing into the Charles Schwab, the US Railroads, and some other names that are more US-centric, that they are making money within the US economy or North America economy. And if you want me to make a kind of like a projection in terms of where we want to be, we don't really care about where the company is listed, whether it's going to be Europe or Asia or the US. But one thing we are quite clear is we want more underlying exposure to North America as a region. So we want more of our fund in terms of the revenue that is going to be generated from North America, not from Europe and not from Asia, and definitely not from China, for example.
Why is that?
So going back to the point that I made earlier about the world outlook is very uncertain, that of course, if you are in Europe or in Germany or even in the UK, you know that this energy crisis is going to buck us for the many years to come. Like in the UK now, we're talking about, should we expand the storage capacity for gas? And I think it got voted down, and some people are suggesting, the government is making a bet that we're not going to have gas shortages, and hence the gas prices, whatever the energy prices, is going to stay low for this coming winter. We don't know that. I mean, it could take place in both scenarios. And at the same time, if you talk about in Germany, in Europe, like you don't want to be in Europe because of what's going on now. And then if you're looking in Asia, I think China is a region that we have avoided for the last many years. That in terms of the geopolitics, I'm not entirely sure whether you want to be investing into the Chinese economy. So let's say if you want to invest into a Chinese company that's going to benefit domestically in China, it's very difficult, right? Like, it could be a hit and miss. And we would rather probably just avoid those opportunities and focus on a region that is politically relatively stable. Like, surely they have their own thing. But then in terms of the strength of the consumers, the US consumers has proven to be the most resilient consumers in terms of spending versus the rest of the world. I'm not saying like it isn't like a no-brainer, because they will still get impacted by inflation, they will still get impacted by high level interest rate, they will still get impacted by higher petrol prices, but it's just on a relative basis, it's a lot less compared to the rest of the world. So if you have to choose, then we would rather have more in North America, but we are highly selective. So we do have some exposure to Asia, like through Nintendo. We have invested into Nintendo, and we like what they're doing in terms of the games and the consoles. And so selectively we do, but it's just like when you take a high level theme, we would have a bias towards the North America region.
And I suppose that's kind of one to watch, as we see, obviously, economies are going to be, well, you would assume economies are going to be having different experiences of the next few years as we move through challenging times. Well, lots of interesting information to unpick there, very useful, but I'm afraid that is all we have time for. So I'd just say thank you, Stephen, for joining us, and thank you, everyone, for listening. Take care.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.